Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 551, Science Faction Microdosing Placebos. I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy, and with me for the first time ever on this show is our comedian, Miss Paige Wesley. Paige, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, I'm good. I'm excited to learn about psychedelics and all kinds of stuff.
And volcanoes.
You know it's good when volcanoes are the less interesting thing on the list.
I think that's also like the Aztec model of success. Like, what are you guys into? Psychedelics and volcanoes.
And volcanoes.
You take one, you jump in the other.
Also calendars,
yeah.
But, you know, don't worry about it. We've got varied hobbies. We're an interesting people.
Oh, now, Damien, of course, our usual host, which, by the way, I mentioned this last week. Paige, I should tell you this as a professional podcaster, practically. You will love this aspect. Damien and I have been doing Science Faction for 7 years. In that time, we have never missed a week.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that by itself. And in that time, Damien has only missed one episode before this.
He actually told... So, okay, behind the curtain, I played D&D with Damien yesterday.
I heard. I always hate on his D&D podcast.
he said that he is afraid that you're going to have me replace him forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't have time for that.
I told him that. I said, Paige is doing 5,000 other things that are way more popular. She has no interest in your shitty job, Damien.
But he said that only one other person had ever been on the show instead of him once. And so the fact that I was the other one, he was high praise.
Hell,
Bobby trusted you.
And Paige, you are, of course, the host and creator of Cult Podcast, which is probably,
yes.
Is that your biggest one?
That is the biggest one currently, although Horror Virgin is close on its heels size-wise.
Now, Cult is pretty much what it sounds like. It's about cults.
It's about horses, male horses specifically.
It's about an Indianapolis football team.
Right, right, right.
And then Horror Virgin's about horror movies.
Horror movies.
Uh-huh.
And then earlier in pandemic, we started Romancing the Pod, which is romance movies.
Ah.
Which is growing pretty steadily as well. So I have bitten off more than anyone should chew, and it's because I'm trapped at home with my own thoughts, and that's bad. That's a bad place to be.
I am going to start my own side podcast called Stuck, A Look Into the Life of Porn.
You know what? Here's the thing, though. If there was a podcast that just interviewed porn stars about their jobs, like in a mundane way, the way that we have podcasts to interview comedians about their jobs,
mm-hmm.
I want that for porn stars. I would listen to it every week. I want to hear all of the stories, but told in a way of like, oh my God, you'll never believe what happened to me at work today. Like, that's what I want.
I'll believe it. I saw it on video.
Right, yeah.
And by the way, that was the most unprofessional pizza delivery guy I've ever seen.
I'm vegan, and there was so much sausage in this pizza. What am I going to do?
Paige, I've been on a few of your podcasts. I was on the Om Shinrikyo series for Cult, and you've actually been on The Degenerates, my other podcast, so we've done quite a few things together back and forth, but you have now like taken over the podcast landscape in LA, so everybody who's listening, all like one millionth of Paige's existing audience, go listen to Paige and make absolutely no difference in her current numbers.
Thank you. I mean, I can't tell you how many people, because you thankfully were very gracious with your time and gave my co-host Armando a crash course in quantum mechanics.
Oh, that's right.
For an episode a couple weeks ago. And then I have just been getting DMs ever since of like, which science faction is it?
I know. There's like two old dudes who yell at each other and they started like a week after us and we just keep hoping they'll die before us, but they're clinging on.
This is the same thing with us and Cults by Parcast. And I'm here to tell you that humor wins.
Yes.
Because we were ranked above them in O Magazine's list of cult podcasts. So suck it. Suck it.
Oh, dear. All right. Let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is science articles.
All right, article number one, microdosing placebos.
I'm excited for this one. I was fascinated by this article. I actually read the articles. Does Damien usually read articles?
I don't know that he can read, actually. Okay.
This explains a lot of our playing D&D yesterday.
I will frequently talk about notes that I have sent him, and he looks at me like kind of blank-faced, and I just figure... Yeah, he doesn't know how to read.
I always just thought it was a thing where podcast guests never read notes. Because I send notes to people occasionally if they're going to be on our show, and I have had exactly one person do the homework.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are just like, oh, I'm good enough. And then you feel like going, no. I've done this literally 1,000 times. You're not good enough. You're not.
If you were, you'd be beating my podcast.
That's the name of Paige's next podcast. Tune into Beating My Podcast.
Beating My Podcast. Here's the crazy. The one person that has like done the homework when I sent homework had a more popular podcast than me.
That's why. Like,
that's
there you
gotta
go.
Be why.
So this is an incredibly interesting scientific article that came out. I think it's going to apply to a lot of people who listen to this show. And it's interesting not just for its results, but also for its methodologies. And those of you who have listened to this show long enough know that I am a sucker for good scientific experimental design. So, Paige, have you ever heard of microdosing?
Yes, and we've actually talked about it at length on Cult Podcast a few different times because... I don't know if you know, but cults fucking love psychedelics.
I have heard, yes. Yes, it seems like every one of your episodes comes round back to LSD at some point. Right, LSD and yoga seem to be a common theme.
LSD, yoga, and a guy claiming to be Jesus. That's my other famous through line is we just have a list of people who've claimed to be Jesus all at the same time. So who knows who is actually Jesus at any given time?
I mean, there's an S on the name, so maybe it's plural. Maybe
maybe
Jesus is a many-sided thing.
Should it maybe be Jesus?
Now, you're in LA, so this is actually probably pretty big there. But you guys have probably heard of microdosing as people taking small amounts of psychedelic medications or psychedelic drugs, usually 10% or less of a normal dose. And the idea is that you don't trip. You're not even technically supposed to be really conscious of the effects, but that it has some sort of effect on your mental well-being, your creativity, your anxiety by taking these small amounts on a regular basis. And there are plenty of people who swear by it. But as we have talked about on this show plenty of times, you always must be wary of the placebo effect. You got to realize that, you know, if you are consciously taking something you believe to make yourself better, oftentimes just that thought will make yourself better. And there have been a few studies that seem to indicate that, though they are somewhat small. And the reason is... it's very difficult to do these studies. So psychedelics, almost all of them are still classified as Schedule I drugs, meaning that they are scheduled by the DEA as having no medicinal value. Now, you can say right off the bat, we know that that is a bad scheduling. We know that that is almost completely untrue because we've covered many scientific articles on this podcast that talk about end-of-life care using things like psilocybin or LSD and people indicating that psilocybin or LSD were some of the top five most positive experiences they've had in their lives and have helped them with numerous things. So we know from scientific evidence that that scheduling is probably bad. That doesn't mean anything, though, because the DEA scheduling has nothing to do with science. And so as of right now, they stay in this weird gray zone where you can't really do research on them without jumping through so many hoops, it makes it nearly impossible. Any university who has federal funding essentially cannot do research on them. And one of those weird side notes you get to learn after you study science for a long time, and you go, well, what about all those universities that aren't taking federal funding, those private ones? You find out the number of research universities in the United States that don't take federal funding is exactly zero. So with all of those combined, it basically means there is almost no way to study these effectively except if you get special exemptions from the DEA, and the DEA is not really excited to give those exemptions because any science that overturns their scheduling will make them look bad. And so it's one of those things where the gatekeeper is the person you would be telling on if your study ended up proving anything. Incredibly hard to do anything. So that's a little bit of the background for why we don't have good research, even though all of these psychedelics, essentially, with a few exceptions, basically all those these psychedelics were discovered in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And so we've known about them for a long time, and people have been taking them for a long time.
Yeah, and they did some experiments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is probably why they're scheduled, yeah. to be honest with you.
But they did some amazing ones. I mean, some of the psychological yeah. studies looking at MDMA, psilocybin, LSD for therapeutic uses, where people took it mm-hmm. in the presence of a psychotherapist, where they're like, holy fuck, it was like 3 years of therapy we got done with this patient in 2.5 hours, you know?
Well, I feel like I wouldn't be surprised in the next few years to see them used kind of the way ketamine is used
yeah,
now.
Sure.
Where people are seeing really great results. And like you said, end of life care. If I'm dying, let me trip balls.
Yeah!
Okay. Like, I'm dying. It's not like I'm ruining my life and throwing my life away on drugs. I'm laying in a bed. Let me see dragons. Damn.
It's like the line, I think, in Little Miss Sunshine, where he's like, where the old man is taking heroin.
He's doing heroin.
And he's talking yeah. to the kid, and he's like, if you take this at your age, you're an idiot. And if you don't take it at my age, you're an idiot.
I mean, I listened to an interview with Tommy Lee, and he said that heroin's the best drug he's ever taken, and it's fucking amazing and so much fun. And he was like, yeah, it's great. And I was like, you know what? When I get crazy old, let's yeah. do it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I got to tell you, I have like a crazy old grandma in the home and everything. They're on it. They just call it OxyContin or fentanyl right. or something. Like, they just don't call it heroin. It is heroin.
I'm super sensitive to like opiate derivatives for pain medication. So I can't take a lot of that stuff just because it makes me throw up everything until there's like nothing left to throw up. So I think I need to be in a position where I can also have like hospital grade anti-nausea and then just like trip for days.
To be fair, this is probably a good thing. That's probably why you're Paige Wesley, podcast network creator, and not Paige Wesley, that wrangled out chick on the corner who's throwing yeah. up.
That one who lives in a box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not even a good box. It's a pretty shitty box. So it is incredibly difficult to get this stuff, but we've covered a study that came out even, I think it was about 5 years ago, that talked about, you know, for instance, end of life care, where you had these people who were terrified of dying. They were dying of things like cancer. And yeah. we're not talking about somebody who, you know, has cancer and they're in treatment and they're not sure what's, they're talking about like, okay, you have 3 months left to live.
Right.
You're going to die. Get your shit in order before it happens. And you had these people with this amazing anxiety. I mean, which is totally understandable if somebody just suddenly put a calendar on your lifespan and it wasn't a long calendar. Yeah. And you looked at that, and these people were given psychedelics, in one sense psilocybin, I think the other one was LSD, and they all came out of it saying, that was amazing, I feel so much better, I came to terms with what it meant to die, I no longer have anxiety about it, I'm now ready to enjoy these next 3 months and spend them with my family, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I would imagine that would help. Or you could just make meth in a trailer in the desert.
That's right.
So that your family is taken care of.
Like a fucking American.
Exactly. Exactly.
So how did the researchers get around these problems? Again, this is what I love about creative research design. It's a really neat solution. So they got people who were already microdosing, so you're not giving them drugs, and that then agree to be part of the study. One of my favorite parts of like the little side notes to this is they're like, yeah, we put this ad out for this microdosing study and like 1,500 people came. And then when we told them we weren't giving them drugs, 1,300 of them didn't call us back.
That was my favorite part of the article, because I was like, wow, that's a lot of people. And then it's like, when they found out they had to provide their own drugs, it was like 247 people. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about right.
I just imagine the way they did it too was right outside the clinic, they put a BYOB sign on the entranceway. So these guys provided their own microdosing. You know, they would do mm-hmm. this thing where they would take a certain amount per day of whatever it was. It wasn't just psilocybin. I think some of these guys were using LSD. Some of them were using
mushrooms, yeah. MDMA. It was basically, it kind of ran the gamut
yeah.
of like all psychedelics, essentially.
Yeah. And what they did was they had them put their normal drug amounts in these little green capsules that were identical to a placebo capsule. You would mm-hmm. then put all of your capsules, the psychedelic ones, for 1 week in an envelope. So now you would think of that as the psychedelic envelope. And it had a QR code that the researchers gave you, and you would put that in. And you would do this for each week of the study. So now at the end, let's say you have 10 weeks of these envelopes lined up. 1 week would be a placebo. 1 week would be a activation or a mushroom, psychedelic, something like that. And you would mix them all up, and you, as the individual taking them, would not know which is which. And then every week, you would scan the QR codes, and it would tell you which envelope to take. So the researchers knew if you were taking the placebo or the activation, right, but you wouldn't know. Now, we're going to get into it in a second. There were a couple of hiccups in that, quite literally, in terms of being able to tell whether you had taken the placebo or not. And you have to remember that these are not, there's not researchers going, okay, this is a non-activation dose. You won't see any colored lights. You won't do anything. These are people taking their normal doses. And some of their normal doses might have been quote unquote microdoses, but they could still tell. Some of them still had effects. And as Paige pointed out, they use different substances. And so the activation dose of each one of those would be different. And so therefore, you know, the same amount of mushrooms is going to do something different than the same amount of MDMA in that capsule, et cetera, et cetera. So a couple of complicating factors in there. Still really, really interesting. So each week you would take your microdose. You would then fill out this little survey. I would say, do you think that this is your psychedelic or do you think it's a placebo? And how do you feel? What's your anxiety level? What's your well-being level? That kind of thing. So they got all this data. They went through the entire thing. People went through their weeks, assumingly not knowing. Now, we'll talk about a couple of the issues. One is, as they were going through, people were like, when I burp, it tastes like mushrooms. Right. So even though it was in the capsule, it didn't.
I can still tell.
Yeah, it didn't work. And so the researchers caught on enough. And they're like, okay, all right, so here's what we'll do. We'll give you like some shiitake mushrooms. You put those in the placebo capsule.
Yeah,
and so now you get a mushroom burp no matter what. And then, you know, who knows if that mushroom burp was different or not. But that seemed to level out that playing field enough. There is also obviously the issues we talked about before of people using differing amounts, some of which would be noticeable, the amount they were taking, even though they weren't like, you know, it wasn't a full trip, it might be noticeable. In that case, the researchers weren't able to exactly control for that, so that just became a confounding factor within the study. So what
here was another thing I thought of. So I went through a process where I take medication for an autoimmune disorder.
Okay.
And as I was in the process of being approved for that, I had to take allergy medication every single day so that it would compound in my system, essentially.
Okay.
So what I kept wondering as I was reading this article is, let's say you've been taking psychedelics every single day for a long time.
Right.
Would that amount eventually kind of build up in your system so that even if you had a day off, you would still feel a lot of those effects?
Absolutely. Okay, so we're gonna get to Paige's exact point, because I think she has already brought up one that I have an issue with as well.
Okay.
First off, what were the results of this? They found that people who believed they were microdosing felt greater well-being and less anxiety than those who thought they were taking the placebo envelope, regardless of whether or not they were right. Meaning, maybe some people were taking the mushrooms thinking it was placebo and being like, this ain't shit. And then some people were taking the placebo thinking they were mushrooms and were like, this is why I live!
Which, I mean, think about it. If you're taking LSD and you just got like a bum tablet or whatever and it just didn't work and you still technically microdosed, you could still be like, this sucks.
Yeah, that's true. Because you bring up a good point. They're providing their own, you know? You got the end of the blotter paper and the LSD liquid didn't go into it.
Right, right, right.
That's a whole other confounding factor I hadn't even thought of, which is, you know, you're providing your own stuff and the...
If you got bad shit, that's not the science's problem.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because it means that you have a whole bunch of people who we know are taking placebos, but who are reporting the same results. And that leads you to think, oh my gosh, does that mean microdosing is total bullshit? Does that mean it doesn't work? That is a leap too far. What it does mean is that there is definitely a placebo effect here going on. It's definitely in play. It might even be a big part of what people report as relief, but this would not be definitive evidence to say that microdosing doesn't work and it's all placebo. And we'll go over a few reasons why. So Paige already hit on two big ones. The first one being, you know, who knows how good their drugs are. So that could be a confounding factor. But the second one being, yeah, if this is something that does make you feel better and it's accumulating in your system day after day, how long does it take to get out of your system? And, you know, also this, I looked at the actual raw data, and the raw data from the actual published article in the Science Journal, it wasn't segmented by the reporting times, meaning that they didn't say, hey, they reported this on the first 3 days of the placebo envelope, right? Which would be different than the next 3 days. Like, if we could see those differences where they continued to report during the first 3 days of the placebo envelope that they were still feeling good, if we found that out, but then they didn't report that so much the latter 3 days of that week, well, then we could say, okay, well, maybe there's an accumulation and they still feel good from having dosed for the last 3 months or something.
Yeah, I would actually really like to see this experiment with a higher level of control from the people studying it, where somebody literally, like, where we really do a placebo effect, where it's not either or, where they're not getting like 1 day on, 1 day off.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, this was 1 week on, 1 week off.
Right.
Yes. But same idea.
Yeah. I would love for them to like microdose, and then full stop placebo for like a month and see how long it takes for somebody to start being like, you know, I feel pretty shitty.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know when this started, but like, that's what I want to know, because I feel like that has to be a factor, right? I mean, you're dosing every day.
Yes.
There's no way it's not going to stay in your system a little bit.
Yeah. And especially because we don't, like I said, we don't know when the reporting came, if the good reports came from the earlier part of that placebo week or the later part. And so that could be a big deal. The other thing to think of is this is not really a typical placebo-controlled study, because in a typical placebo-controlled study, you have a placebo group and then you have an activation group. In this case, one individual supplies both sides of it.
Yeah.
That confounds things for a few reasons. Number one, we're dealing with a situation where, as we said, you know, it can accumulate in your system. But number two, we're dealing with people who aren't random people off the street. It's not like I grabbed a whole bunch of random people and said, here's this heart disease medication you've never heard of before. We're going to test it on you and we're going to see if you get negative effects or not. You grab people who are already microdosing in order to try and solve a problem, depression, anxiety, so, you know, creative issues, something like that, who supposedly, whether placebo or not, felt some relief from it in the first place. Otherwise, they wouldn't still be doing it. And so we've already had these people who said, I've tried this thing and it works. Well, that kind of takes them out of the general placebo, non-placebo control group. And if you tried something and it did work, like, let's say I have a chronic back pain, which I do, right? And let's say I have aspirin and aspirin makes my back pain feel better. And I know that aspirin makes my back pain feel better. If I then get a placebo later on, there is a well-documented effect in science where part of a drug's effect on you has to do with your set and your setting, meaning you're sitting there. I know I take this aspirin every night before I go to bed. I know it's going to start affecting me as I'm watching this TV show before I go, and then I'm going to get blah, blah, blah. And it's just almost like a ritual that is part of the effects of that medication. The reason it works is because the medicine does work, and it has worked so many times that the ritual becomes part of what makes that effective. And so if the microdosing was effective early on and did help these people, then the ritual of taking that every day can reinvigorate that, and they'll get an even bigger placebo response from that. Long story short, in this, it means that if you are using something that is effective for you, and then you try and quote unquote like placebo it, you try and throw something else in and call it a placebo, it is a very different scenario than just randomly telling somebody you're getting a placebo or you're not for a drug they've never tried before, and for which they are literally either in an activation group or a placebo group.
Right. Yeah. If somebody replaced my autoimmune medication with not autoimmune medication, I'd figure it out eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
But interesting note. So I was in a trial group. It was a medication testing that then got approved, and now I get to take it like a regular person. But because of complications with insurance, I had to be without it for 6 months and did not have symptoms return.
Ooh.
Because it had stored up enough in my body at that point that I made it basically through the gap. So that's what makes me think that, like, yeah, you would have to test to see when exactly that microdosing truly wears off.
And I mean, that's a great point too, is that there are certain conditions whereby treatment, it's not always just like, does the medicine wear off, but treatment has an effect in terms of later remission, right? So
yes,
you know, we see this with cancer. Like, at some point you stop taking your chemotherapy and the cancer goes away.
Right.
To some extent, other diseases are like that, where if you have knocked that disease down enough with the activation medicine, then even if you switched over to a placebo or stop taking it, as in your case, mm-hmm. then you are still experiencing relief from the period of time you did that. And one of the big conditions we know is like that is depression. We know that when you treat depression, it has an effect on later depression. We know that people learn to manage feelings. One of the big things is when people are really badly depressed, they feel like there's no answer. You'll never be solved. They'll never be okay again. And a lot of times seeing that you can be okay again then gives that person hope the next time it gets really bad, because they go, I remember it was really bad last time, but I got better. There was light right. at the end of the tunnel.
I'll get through it. Yeah. It's not the end. Yes. Yeah.
So very interesting study. However, it doesn't mean that microdosing doesn't work, but it also does mean that we should be skeptical of microdosing as a panacea for all things like anxiety and depression that we desperately need truly double-blinded studies for. And we need proper control and activation groups before we can decide what the next fad cure is, etc., especially when it comes to mental health. However, we should also comment that when we're talking about something like depression, severe anxiety, these type of things, a lot of times these are fatal conditions. These are conditions in which people end up taking their own lives. And so if they are getting relief from something, even if that thing is a placebo, but especially if it's not, it isn't always a great idea to just say, hey, stop taking it. So if you're out right. there and you're microdosing and you're getting positive benefits from it, I certainly wouldn't advise you to just suddenly assume it's all placebo and not working. And if you see this study out there, I want you to hear that that is not what this means. What it does mean is that we should be skeptical of any claims of microdosing, especially the big ones you see. The ones that you'd be especially wary of are the people who are like, yeah, I don't need antidepressants anymore. Yeah, I don't need my normal medication, right? Nothing that we've seen would represent a good reason to get off a doctor-prescribed course of action for somebody with really severe depression. But there are some promising results that in the future, certain therapies might be utilizing some of the chemicals we find here in psychedelics that do treat the brain differently. And we do, at least in this case, so as opposed to kind of like magic crystal cures, we do have things like mechanisms of action, because we've seen fMRI studies where we have seen people's brains under the effects of certain types of psychedelic drugs, where we can see the brain activating in different fashions while they're on that drug, and then subsequently after the effects of that drug wear off, their brain continues to react and act in different functions, different parts light up, which leads us to think that single exposures or experiences with certain types of psychedelics might be able to do a reset button type things for certain people with mental issues like depression.
Yeah, the stuff I take, they're like, yeah, definitely still keep an asthma inhaler on you. like, we're glad this is working, but if you start to die, we're going to need you to have that. So I would say at this point from reading this study, it makes me feel like we should actively be studying this more as an option.
Yeah.
But yeah, don't throw your Prozac out.
Yeah.
Not yet.
And let me just say, as a huge research design nerd, it was one of the things I specialized in graduate school, love research design. I'm going to make a suggestion to anybody out there who's thinking about doing another microdosing study that still complies with federal regulations. Instead of doing it the way you did, if you can find a group of conglomerates to agree to do so, do the same type of study, except this time, you know, have them put all the stuff in the envelopes and you got their psychedelics in the envelopes and stuff, but have one group get only their psychedelics and one group get only their placebos. So we have a true activation group and a true placebo group, and that's going to tell us so much more. As Paige said, if you wanted to control even better, you might have everybody maybe stop taking everything for a month or so beforehand just to kind of clear out the system and then have like more of a blank palette. So we're going to call this the Paige and Bobby microdosing protocol for future research. Yeah.
First, you need a cleanse. And then trip balls. Write down what you think. Tell us what you see. How many dragons are there?
Wouldn't it be great if they're like, listen, yeah, we got a lot of good results, but honestly, not enough dragons.
Yeah. Our findings are Pink Floyd's The Wall still fucking slapped. I don't know if that's science, but it's true.
Article number 2, is Iceland about to blow?
I was very worried initially when you sent me this. I'd only read only read the headline, and I texted you about it. And I was like, oh, and then I read the rest of it and it was fine. But for like a hot second, I was like, damn it, I wanted to see Reykjavik. And if Iceland blows up, that's going to really wreck my travel plans.
Iceland has always been super interesting to me because they're such a bizarre, unique, just like off on their own culture of weird ass Vikings, you know, like just such a weird group. And scientifically, they're one of the most interesting people on Earth because they have kept detailed genealogies going back to the 1500s, where we know literally every single, if you pick a person in Iceland that was born between now and 1555, we can look them up and be like, here's his dad, here's his kids, here's his 18th cousin, and we have a genealogy tree that includes everybody in Iceland, which is crazy.
And they have a witch museum. Like, fucking rad.
They're a weird people.
Yeah.
Not only do they have the detailed genealogy, but they also have detailed genetics to back it up. Iceland became the first country where every individual citizen of Iceland had their genome sequenced and then put into a giant database, which we now use as the gold standard for like genetic surveys and tests and stuff, because we can see how one gene flows through a population. Plus, we can then reference it to the genealogy paperwork and be like, oh yeah, and this guy and this guy. And then you can reference it to the genealogy paperwork and be like, and this bitch cheated because she says these are...
there was a rough 23andMe test in my family a couple years ago. So, yeah, okay. I mean, first of all, before we even get to that, that just means that no one in Iceland can murder anybody. And
that's
where's the fun in that?
Yes.
But a couple years back, my uncle did a 23andMe, and my dad has a pretty unique middle name.
Okay.
And it always kind of sounded like a last name. We thought it was strange. He's a junior, so like it was his father's name. So our uncle... we'd always been told that we were certain nationalities and had potentially certain backgrounds. And then the test came back and none of that was there. And so we kind of traced stuff back and found out that my dad's middle name was the last name of a young college student that they rented a room to while my great-grandfather was away at war.
Oh, snap! That's pretty crazy.
So we're pretty sure that our great-grandfather was probably not our great-grandfather, but we also didn't like that guy. Yeah. So it's fine.
I wish you would have stayed at war, great-grandfather.
Well, I mean, he was super sexist. So like...
I mean, when you get old enough, like, once you get past the 1950s, haven't you just described every dude?
Everyone.
Yeah.
When one of my cousins was born, there are no male cousins on that side of the family. And he was mad that no one was going to continue the last name. And I was like, screw you. I have a stage name anyway. But so when my cousin was born, they called and were like, hey, we had the baby. And he was like, it's a girl. And then hung up the phone. So, you know. Great dude.
That's okay. You could then call him up later and be like, listen, I know you need a blood transfusion, but it's not a match. Grandma cheated. Bye.
Bye. He left us money and my dad was like, yeah, you can definitely spend that on an electric guitar. I don't give a shit. He hated girls. Do what you want.
That's great. But yeah, Iceland, one of those super interesting places and also very genetically homogenous. I mean, this is a place that was founded by a small group of Vikings, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And then since then has stayed pretty isolated on its own. So what is very interesting now and is one of the kind of downsides of living off in the middle of nowhere, off on your own on an island in the middle of the Atlantic, is there's a lot of volcanic activity on Iceland. And what we've noticed, as seismologists have reported on for the past week, is more than 20,000 earthquakes in southern Iceland following a 5.7 quake that occurred on February 24th. 20,000, Paige!
That's a lot. I grew up near Hayward on the fault.
Sure.
So I don't get out of bed for anything under 6.
Yeah.
But that's still a lot. That's a lot. I realize that I am desensitized because of my upbringing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yes. I mean, yes. Any place, if you are in basically Western California, you grew up feeling enough earthquakes. And then the funny part is nobody else is from here. So when people come here from Kansas or whatever, and there's like a 3-point something and they run out and stand in a doorway and you just giggle to yourself.
Oh, there was one a couple years ago. My co-host on Cult Podcast, Andrea Gazzetta, who is from Milwaukee. She's from Wisconsin, and it was her first one, and she did not like it. She did not have a good time, and it was not a big one. But yeah. Yeah. It's pretty fun to watch people freak out about it.
So is 20,000 the crazy number? It's pretty big, but most of these are pretty small. Only two of these 20,000 after the initial 5.7 cracked 5 on there. And you remember the Richter scale is logarithmic. And so, you know, the difference between a 4 and 5 isn't 0.1. You know, you're going a logarithmic scale. So you're going up 10 each time. And so this is a 10 times as high. So the difference between a earthquake that's ranked 4 and an earthquake that's ranked 5 is 10 times as strong, not 1/10 up each time. And so it is true that that is a lot, but we actually get earthquake swarms like this around here. We had some out in the desert not too long ago. We had some up in Ridgecrest about a year and a half ago, and they're usually associated here in California with earthquakes. Up there in Iceland, they're usually associated, especially in southern Iceland, with impending volcanic activity. Now that is much scarier, because to me it's just like, all right, we'll get a few more earthquakes here and we're fine. But up there, they're like, I really hope the island doesn't blow up.
I was thinking about how lackadaisical I am about earthquakes as I read this article, and they were like, yeah, it's slow moving lava. It's like a tourist volcano.
Yes, no, that's the greatest. That's the greatest. The greatest quote is, they go, don't worry, it's southern Iceland, because, you know, we had this big thing. I'm sure everybody remembers this. In 2010, there was a big eruption in Iceland, a big volcanic eruption that like stopped intercontinental travel across the Atlantic for a week. People were stuck in Europe, and it was fucking crazy. A bunch of people in Iceland had to leave where they were living, et cetera, et cetera. That was a big eruption. But this is in southern Iceland, where they have these basalt flows, which are like slow moving lava flows, which the ice Icelandic people, as only a people who are honed by hard weather and constant volcanic eruptions could call it, they label these tourist eruptions.
Tourist eruptions. It was so funny. As someone who lives in a place besieged by tourists, and occasionally I'll see celebrities in the wild and just be like, oh yeah, whatever. And like, my mom is always just like, That was Jimmy Kimmel. Like, what are you doing? You didn't even care. To think that someone thinks of volcanoes that way is insane.
I also, side note, I also found my new name for a brothel that I'm going to open, which is Tourist Eruptions.
Tourist Eruptions? Oh, man.
Because of the type of volcanoes that are along the southern line of Iceland, this basically leads to these slow-moving kind of lava fields that kind of run out, and they're fun to go see, but they don't really cause that big damage that we saw in the 2010 thing. So don't worry if you are planning to be in Europe soon. You're probably not going to get stuck there by some kind of huge eruption. This is more likely just something small. The reason I wanted to cover this, even though it doesn't seem like it's something dramatic, is to think of that difference. So this is what struck me when I was reading this. I had not before studied up enough on volcanic activity in Iceland to be aware of this, but imagine this. You get a shaking of 20,000 earthquakes, and you're in southern Iceland, and you go, no big deal, just a slow-moving lava field, tourist eruptions. Now you get that exact same thing, you know, 50, 100 miles north in northern Iceland, and you're wondering if the top of your country is going to blow off at any given second.
Yeah, is this Vesuvius Part 2?
Right, and we're not talking about like, hey man, it happened back in, you know, Krakatoa, it happened back in 1700s or something. It's like, this happened 11 years ago, and it was a huge deal, and it stopped intercontinental travel and nearly shut the country down. Like, it's a big fucking, it was part of their, it was part of the thing that like shut down their economy and caused a huge recession and stuff there. It was a huge deal. Think of the difference. Like, you were just talking about growing up in Hayward. I grew up in Southern California. We have the same experience with earthquakes. There's an earthquake coming. You're fine. Is it up to, is the chandelier shaking a lot? All right, go stand in the doorway. Otherwise you're fine. It's okay. Right. But that same distance, Hayward to San Diego. Had we been in Iceland, I'm going, we're fine, we're fine. You're running and screaming yeah. from the hills as a huge mountain blows up behind you.
I mean, to demonstrate it, I lived through 89.
Yeah.
And remember my mom running through the house to carry me outside and then watching the street roll.
Yeah.
But like, and that's, my mom grew up in California too, so she knows them. But yeah, you guys didn't feel it down where you are.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah.
So there yeah. you go.
But neither of us thought that our world was about to blow up and, you know, stop no. airline travel around the world for the next few days. Very, very interesting. I just love those little nuances where you're like, oh no, there's a swarm of volcanoes in Iceland. And then you look at the guy and go, what part of Iceland?
What part of it?
Do I have to worry about half the world ending? Or is this just something that I'm going to see really cool videos for on YouTube?
Yeah, probably the latter. My dad for a while worked for a company that built housing, and one of their communities was in Hawaii mm-hmm. during the eruptions a couple years back.
Sure.
And I was like, Dad, is anything going to happen? He's like, psh. They signed a contract that said that they knew that lava might flow through their yard, but the house is going to be fine. Like, it was that same like.
Wait, so he builds only lava-proof houses?
No, apparently it's zoned out. So like if you buy a house in a certain zone, you have to acknowledge that you're like, my house might be lava someday. The floor might literally be lava. But it was, again, like a slow moving thing where there was videos of just like the street kind of bubbling.
Yeah.
And then they were just like, you need to evacuate. And they're like, fine, I'll get my stuff. I'm just kind of like walking away slowly. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, meth is a hell of a drug. All right. Thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 551, where you learned all about microdosing placebos and whether or not Iceland is about to blow. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, Paige, for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
For Science Faction 551.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.